Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Daily French Show. I'm standing in for Nick Lorimer, who's busy semigrating. He's leaving God's own country, aka Gauteng, and moving to the Western Cape, where Michael Morris is. Good afternoon, Michael.
Hello, Alan Morris. Hi, Terence. I'm sorry to say that Nicholas's first sort of few days here have been sort of rained out a bit, which is not really the kind of early summer weather we like to show off to newcomers. But I hope it doesn't hold it against us. So
Yeah,
yeah,
if you should send some of that rain to Gauteng. It's been flipping this weekend in Joburg
I
was
believe so.
unbearably hot. Yeah. And how's it, Terence? How are you? I hope you managed to survive the heat in Gauteng this week.
It's oppressively hot.
It's,
Like
yeah,
it
it's
just
one of
it's
those where
like
you
the
just
weather is like the dysfunction in our politics.
Exactly. It's one of those where you struggle to sleep. So, but moving to our first story today. So Pretoria Girls High, or I think its official name is Pretoria High School for Girls, has been in the news quite a lot lately. There was accusations that there was this kind of racist cabal amongst some of the girls. They were sending racist WhatsApps to each other, and there was this really big investigation into it. And first, there was all these accusations that these girls were racist, but once some investigation been done, came to light that they weren't actually racist. And Thabo Mbeki actually came out and said he did his own investigation, and he said he thought that what the Gauteng Department of Education done was completely wrong, and they'd accused these poor girls of racism and said they were racist when there was no real proof of that. But the school's still in the news, so excuse me. So a report now has been released by the Gauteng Education Department. It's from a law firm called Madlad Lamba Attorneys, which the department commissioned to probe allegations of racism into the into Pretoria Girls. And so all these kinds of claims have now emerged, saying that the teachers at the school are racist, especially the white teachers, because they don't greet their fellow black colleagues, apparently. And this is because they don't know whether they are cleaners or educators at the school. And I have to say, just from that, I found that a little bit strange. I mean, when I was at school, I mean, I would imagine things aren't different. Obviously, when I was in school in the 90s, all the teachers were white, but the cleaning staff, they'd kind of wear overalls and so on. And I imagine now you'd see, like the cleaning staff probably would still wear overalls. And I also don't know why people still wouldn't greet the cleaning staff. It seems to me you would greet your colleagues, whether they members of the cleaning staff or members of the teaching staff. It seems a bit strange. I mean, it's quite rude not to greet somebody just because, they're doing more menial work than being on the and not a teacher, or whatever the case is. So to me, I don't know. This I see somebody in the comments says manufactured, and I think, it wouldn't surprise me. I don't know, Terence, what do you think? Do you think this is overblown, or do you think there's perhaps some merit to these accusations?
My own view is that this is kind of the evidence, however thin, that the education department had to have. Remember, Gauteng's education department is particularly seized with these matters whenever there is an allegation. It sinks a great deal of publicity into it, and let's remember that when this story came out. An official went, and I think very unethically riled up the student body. Should we suspend these delinquents or not? And said, well, we're going to take action whether they about racism, whether there's tangible evidence or not. His words, not mine. Now, I think that they were handed something of a defeat when the disciplinary committee, which I understand was composed entirely of black people, went through the evidence and said there was nothing there. And then Thabo Mbeki came out. So they then upon receiving the disciplinary outcome, they said, well, they're going to investigate whether there is a culture of racism. It's one of those things where you don't actually have to get an instance of racism. You can sort of go on vibes. And the interesting thing is that if you look at the reporting on this, I haven't had the opportunity to look at the actual report by this firm. They say, well, this has been reported, but nobody has
nobody has actually been able to name anybody else. So in other words, are we talking about something that happens as a matter of course? Are we talking about what, you know, one or two instances, you know, which may have been in a crowded room or something? You know, the way things come across to people can be very different from the manner in which they're intended. And I'll just say this, that I attended an all-white school, you know, prior to integration. This is the 1980s. And I do recall, and look, trust me, racism was not something that was unknown to my school culture, so I'm not trying to golden age it. But cleaning staff, call them the black staff, as sometimes as they were referred to, were, you know, generally greeted, I would say, by the teaching staff, you know, as people they worked with, you know, maybe in a subordinate position, but, you know, a sort of good morning or, you know, please and thank you, that sort of thing was unremarkable. So this doesn't pass the smell test, but I do think it gives an education department that has a particular investment in this sort of narrative enough cover to sort of keep you know, to keep its chosen narrative moving. This is my fear. And unfortunately, I don't think this bodes well for the next couple of months. But then again, is education, the imparting of knowledge, the molding of young minds for academic purposes, the primary consideration of our education bureaucracy?
Yeah, and I think, as you said, it doesn't really pass the smell test. I think one of the lines here is saying, the principal indicator that a challenge is that the administration staff do not want to name the educators that are ill-treating them, and thus she cannot take the necessary disciplinary steps against them. And I don't know, that just seems something that's... We've seen all kinds of things in the past where people are accused of being racist and their accusers don't come forward. But you're not really going to get anywhere if you can't say the people who is actually mistreating you. So, I don't know, Michael, do you agree with Terrence? Do you think this is failing to pass the smell test? Do you think there's maybe something to this?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have qualms about it. I will just say as a start, I consulted a school-going person a little while ago, about an hour ago, about this, and his response was, yeah, I can picture that. and it's just, you know... I think it's what it speaks to in a way is also the kind of enduring quality of stereotypes in this society, and that some schools really do have quite kind of old-fashioned structures, and the kinds of people they employ sometimes are, you know, might be from a world that is not especially enlightened. I don't know. I can't really explain that, other than to say I think stereotypes are quite strong. One of the problems today might be that, you know, all the staff are now, because they're treated better, there's much less hierarchical situation than in Terrence's day, and I remember that too. You'd refer to, you know, anyone doing menial staff, you could refer to as black staff, because basically those are the only people who are going to be doing menial jobs. Now it's very different. You have teachers who and training staff that are doing sports teams and all the rest, but also all the staff would be given, you know, liveried, not overalls necessarily anymore. It might be tracksuits, and it may not be that easy to distinguish between teachers and ground staff purely on the grounds of what they look like. So the immediate question would be, you know, it's 2024, for heaven's sake, surely teachers know who the teachers are. So if there is a problem, I think that then it needs to be confronted. And the report here does seem to say that the principal says this is the biggest frustration that she must deal with at the school, including the ill treatment of the administration staff by some educators. So if that is an issue, that's got to be confronted. But the report then goes on to say the principal indicated that her challenge is that the admin staff don't want to name the educators. And that really that's not good enough. You can't simply come out in public and say there is a problem without actually being able to say this is how we're tackling it. We've got the facts. It's provable. It's, you know, it'll stand up in a decent open inquiry. And I think without that, it's mischievous actually, because it feeds into all the assumptions and the various stereotypes you're trying to address. It's actually probably going to make them more intensive and make people resentful. It was quite interesting just looking through a bit further down that story, where there's a discussion about the children sharing things on a WhatsApp group, and one is talking about, you know, trying to get into a provincial A team or get into medical campuses at university if you're white skinned. We could argue, you know, whether that's racist or not. I don't necessarily think it is. It's just a young South African expressing frustration at the conditions in which he or he is finding, you know, in which they're finding themselves, and where their race is being constantly made the kind of preeminent measure of who they are and what they're worth. And so it really does underline the thing that we keep saying at the IRR. We've got to get over this idea that we can impose these definitions on other people, and consider other ways to assess the merits and the virtues of our fellow South Africans. So quite a mixed bag. I think the key thing, there's got to be evidence. You can't simply run around and make claims. And I think Terence is right. There's a sense here that the education department in Gauteng, it does have a history of wanting to stir up problems without sufficient basis. There was that telling line that Terence mentioned. We're going to find the problem here, whether there's evidence or not. That is what actually enraged Thabo Mbeki as well, as you pointed out, Maurice, that this is a completely absurd thing for anyone to say, and that it brings disrepute on the very administration of which he has, you know, some kind of fraternal link. So, yeah, I think those are the key things. There might be an issue here, but then we've got to know, we've got to have the names, and there's got to be evidence. Otherwise, it's mischievous.
Let's hope that this doesn't have. Go on, Dad.
Look, let me just make one observation. I also thought that the extracts from the WhatsApp conversations were curious, because they seem to be reporting what people's perceptions. And I wonder if, at some level, the writer of this article wasn't so much reflecting on the empirical accuracy as to as much as a sense that the values attached to these comments are unacceptable. Not disputing whether they're empirically true, but whether you're supposed to think they're good or bad. I mean, isn't the whole point about racial preferencing that, you know, you are supposed to distribute those to particular groups as opposed to others? You know, you're just supposed to be doing it for the right reason. I think there was a piece that we published by in the Daily Friend a couple of years ago by Darren Zook, who's an American academic, actually from UC Berkeley of all places, where he dealt with this question of anti-racism and said, if you look at its foundational text, you don't see an empirical objection to the idea, to the foundational ideas of racism, merely that you want a different form of it. And I think this is a very, very hazardous area to start getting into, to say, well, yes, you know, we agree this is what's happening, but you may not think about it in that way. We want you to think about it in another way, you know, or we don't want you to think about it at all, but we can think about it. I mean, there's a whole kind of code and vocabulary built into there, which is enormously destructive. And, you know, the phrase social cohesion is just not possible when that is how you're trying to structure your communication environment.
It's all a bit concerning, and let's hope that Pretoria Girls High, it's quite a storied institution, obviously. Let's hope it comes out of this bit stronger, but I have my concerns about that. It could damage the school irrevocably, so it's not great. But moving on, I think we could probably talk about that for another half an hour if we wanted. I think last month there were two elections in Southern Africa, which are very different outcomes. So the first one was in Mozambique, where the governing Frelimo apparently won with 70% of the vote, and it's a presidential candidates also got around about 70% in the election. But people, there's been claims of rigging, saying that the governing Frelimo stole the election, that an independent guy actually won. And there's actually been some concerning scenes of violence from there. Apparently, already over 100 people have been killed. There's apparently been clashes in Maputo. It's all pretty concerning. But then in Botswana, also had an election last week. And there, the governing BDP, Botswana Democratic Party, which had been in power since 1966, since independence, they actually lost the election on Wednesday. And by Friday morning, the president of the country and the BDP, Mkhwisi Masisi, already gave his concession speech and said, yeah, well, we lost, and good luck to Duma Boko and the Umbrella for Democratic Change, who's going to be the new political party there. So, Terence, do you think what happened in South Africa had any kind of influence over Botswana? Do you think maybe it galvanized the opposition there? And what do you think, I mean, what's the next step with regard to Mozambique? It's been a place that's suffered quite a lot in the 20th century, I think. I mean, it's never been really a democracy. It's the fifth poorest country in the world by GDP per capita, and that's in 2024. So, yeah, what do you make of all that?
What we do know, funnily enough, from political science analysis of this is that the more functional democracies you have in a particular area, the more there's a sort of democratic contagion that works the other way, where democracies fail, it's more likely that, you know, functioning democracies will regress. So, you know, perhaps there is something to that South Africa had this sort of earthquake election, and maybe that did embolden the opposition in Botswana. That being said, Botswana has been a one-party dominant state, but has still been a formal democracy since independence, I think. And I think it's the only one in post-colonial Africa, with a possible exception of Senegal. I'm not 100% sure, but I think that they've also maintained a sort of democratic tradition. But point is, very, very rare. I think that this is the sort of end point. Botswana, for the past sort of 15 years, has seen its reputation tarnished. It's in a bit of an economic rut. It's got, you know, problems with being an extremely resource-dependent society. And there's been a sort of securitization of the state, which hasn't gone down well with everyone. I think that this is, in a sense, something both profoundly important, and that you did see this shift for the first time in a decade. Well, first time since Botswana became an independent country. But also there's something almost boring about it. This is what a democracy is supposed to do. Now, the interesting thing across in Mozambique, I wonder whether, the events in South Africa didn't perhaps shake up their ruling party, because the ANC and Frelimo have long-standing ties. And if perceptive listeners will recall that back at the time of the Zimbabwean crisis, this was early 2000s, the liberation movements, so there's like Angola, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and South Africa, started to get together to coordinate, because they reckoned that Zimbabwe was under threat, and therefore they were all under threat, and this was kind of the final struggle to stay in power. And I think the fact that the ANC lost its majority and had to, you know, acquiesce in an agreement with white monopoly capital and the scorn of settler colonialism and whatever, must have been deeply, deeply disconcerting to its ideological brethren. On the other hand, you know, Mozambique just doesn't have our sort of institutions. Whatever our problems are, you know, we're in a much better position there. It doesn't have the civil society. It doesn't have the judiciary and whatever. And I suspect that Frelimo had decided a long time ago that it wasn't going to countenance a defeat. I mean, I remember going back as far as the 1990s, you know, just after the democratization, even people who were, I'd say, fairly sympathetic to Frelimo would say that, yeah, you know, they won the election, but there was a lot of cheating. So, and I think that what you have here is the passing of a generation. People who are just, you know, fed up and frustrated with misgovernance, and don't have that recollection of the past, and also they don't have a sort of enemy within in terms of you know, like a vestige of a Portuguese community or something to for the government to point at. In fact, they've got new order challenges like the Islamist insurgency that probably there's a lot more, much more of a present tense a threat, which really has no linkages back then.
Yeah, so then these problems in Mozambique aren't new, obviously. I mean, they became a formal democracy in the early 1990s, but you both might remember the killing of Carlos Cardoza, who's that famous investigative Mozambican investigative journalist. Actually, a guy of the white Mozambican, so neither here nor there, but he was killed in early 2000s for trying to uncover corruption in Mozambique. Michael, so what do you think? How should South Africa react to what's happening in Mozambique? We've been pretty soft on autocracies, whether they're in the region or abroad. I mean, I think that there's an argument to be made that the only reason ZANU-PF is still in power in Zimbabwe is because of the support it got from Pretoria and Thabo Mbeki in the early 2000s. And I mean, he has an opportunity now. I mean, should we, you know, what should our stance be to Mozambique?
I do remember, it probably would have been in the 90s, I suppose, once interviewing F.W. de Klerk and asking him about Thabo Mbeki in Zimbabwe. And he's saying to me, you know, there's not very much that a head of state can do about a neighboring state. Everybody wants you to intervene, but there isn't really very much you can do. But that said, I did say that I, you know, surely there's a responsibility to speak out. And he kind of smiled and agreed. But so, I mean, I think technically, perhaps there's not a lot that can be done, but there's certainly you can express a sentiment which would probably speak directly to emboldening opposition forces in that country. I think that's really a key thing. And Terence has written a lot recently and spoken a lot about this whole idea of narrative formation, and we're looking at it partly also in the Pretoria High School for Girls saga. But looking at the story, Marius, that you shared earlier on Mozambique from Al Jazeera, the intro tells us something quite interesting. It begins by saying, rights activist Chidiya Chisunga has spent the last few days poring over images she never thought she'd see in Mozambique. And this was young men with bloodied bodies, pockmarked with bullet wounds, teenagers with eyes swollen shut from being hit with tear gas canisters by the Mozambique police. So there's this kind of quite, it's essentially a kind of sentimental disbelief in the idea that a liberation government could ever be so bad that people would turn against it. You know, it's quite a hurdle, I think, for people to get over in a place like South Africa, even certainly in a place like Mozambique. So even a rights activist finds it quite difficult to make sense of these images when, you know, if you ask us, well, any government is capable of, if it abuses power, if it gets too much power and is given too much power, it's likely going to abuse it. And every government has got to be watched very closely. I mean, it's a point we make all the time. And then the interesting thing is, in contrast, in Botswana, not that the Botswana government needs to be watched any less diligently or vigilantly. I think, you know, I don't know much about it. I'd be interested to hear your views, Marius, on the new governing party there. But it is a very different place. You and I have spoken a bit recently about that. Those two economists, Darren Acemoglu and Stephen Robinson, have just recently won the I think jointly with someone else, the Nobel Prize for Economics. In their book, Why Nations Fail, they deal quite comprehensively with the Botswana experience and Botswana history. And one of the things that they bring out, it's their theme, is to focus on the power of, or the importance of powerful institutions that are also inclusive, both economic and political, is that the foundation of Botswana, in a way, even though it was poor when it became independent in the 60s, it had a very, very strong inclusive political institution in the tribal khotla, and the manner in which people accepted a kind of government that was accountable, that could be altered, that wasn't necessarily hereditary, and so on. All kinds of complex forces at play in their political imagination, and I think that stood that country in very good stead, and it led also to they're not automatically thinking in terms of nationalizing mines when the mines were found. So whatever problems there are, and I think they've had what high increasing unemployment, I think, and the resource problems, the resource economy that Terence has mentioned. But one hopes that, you know, it has the institutional fabric and strength to withstand all those pressures. Yeah, but I'd be interested to hear from you, Maurice. What do you make of the new government there?
Well, I was going to say, I think Botswana has also got a few other advantages in that it's quite a homogenous society. Most people there are Tswana.
Yeah,
it's not. But that also doesn't mean a society is going to do well. I mean, Eswatini and Somalia are both homogenous, and they obviously very poor and are places wrecked by conflict and so on. And but I also think the fact that the British were pretty hands off in their colonization of Botswana. They didn't really. They're the kind of traditional leadership structures and so on were left intact, and they were modern democratic ways of governing were brought alongside the traditional ways of that the people in Botswana used to govern themselves. So I think that's also been part of it. But yeah, this new party, this Umbrella for Democratic Change, they ran on a very populist platform. They said they're going to create 500,000 jobs out of a population of 2 million, which is already something you start raising your eyebrows at. And how does a government create 500,000 jobs? That's not really possible. They're also going to more than double the minimum wage, they said. They're going to make sure that all school girls in primary and high school have access to sanitary pads, which, I mean, that's good, but it's pretty, the stuff's not free. Somebody's got to pay for it. And they also said Botswana is a constitutional dictatorship. So they're going to, they want to relook at the constitution. So who knows what that means? All stuff that's it's pretty concerning. So, but like Terence said, this is how democracies work. You vote out the other guys and let these guys have a go for a bit. And, if they mess things up, then I'm sure they'll be booted out at the next election, as long as they follow all the democratic norms that you're supposed to. And let there be space for open political contestation and let votes be counted as they should be. Now, Terence, do you have any views on these new guys, this Umbrella for Democratic Change? Who's actually they're actually a coalition of parties, including Botswana National Front, which is quite left-wing.
Yeah, from everything I understand, and I've been following this for about 15 years for various reasons. It's a coalescence rather than a coalition of people who are hurtful with what they see as sort of a sclerotic political class. I think really that I suspect the realities of governing will put a big damper on some of their plans. I would just like to pivot to something that Michael said about and also you said about South Africa's culpability for Zimbabwe. And I agree that unless you're really going to roll the tanks in, and our tanks don't work, you can't. There's a limit to what you're able to do. I do think though that in the case of Zimbabwe, and I also think the case of the contagion effect in places like Angola and Mozambique. South Africa was very generous, for instance, with giving Zimbabwe credit, food aid, all sorts of things, which the incumbent government then was able to use to weaponize for itself. The other thing was that, remember, in around 2000, there was the NEPAD initiative. And the whole idea was Africa was going to move from non-interference to non-indifference. And I think that although maybe there's a limit to what you can practically do, you can signal, that this is not okay. And I think that if you are in, that if you were Robert Mugabe, in your hotel suite in Singapore, you understood that ultimately South Africa had your back. And, I think that destroyed a once in a generation opportunity for Africa to pivot. It wasn't only in Zimbabwe, but it showed just how effectively hollow those commitments were.
Yeah, it's as you said, unless you were going to roll the tanks in, which post-apartheid South Africa we only did once in Lesotho. That's when Mangosuthu Buthelezi was president for a week, I think. Then he got quite excited, decided he wanted to start invading his neighboring countries.
We didn't have maps or something. We had to stop at the holiday to ask for directions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's quite an exciting time in Southern Africa, I think, with what's happened in Botswana. Hopefully Mozambique gets their act together. There's also an election in Namibia at the end of the month. where Swapo is also not guaranteed of winning. So it's also something to watch. And yeah, we could be having a coalition government or maybe even a brand new government in Swapo. But apparently the polling says Swapo might just squeak a majority. But yeah, that remains to be seen. Thanks to everybody who listened and joined us. Hopefully we didn't bore you too much with our talk about Southern African electoral politics. I'm not too sure when Nick Lorimer is back or when he's going to be unpacked everything in Cape Town. But thanks for joining us. And we'll see you guys tomorrow.